May it please the court, your honors, opposing counsel, co-counsel, Peter O'Bain, 1392. Distinguished guest, Dr. Bellaby, myself, M. Cullen, Z, registration 25452. The heart of this case comes down to a very simple issue. It's a double jeopardy argument. And the crux of this is very simple. There's no doubt that there was a stipulated amount of restitution. We have, without going on into the details and facts, the record's full of this issue. You know, from the simple fact of the people preparing a restitution order, which is part of the record, page 68, to the plea agreement of the parties that is handwritten by the prosecution, the deputy district attorney, Michael Royster, in this case. It's only relevant because the court knows we hold documents written by the party, most particularly against that party. Specifically in there, he handwrote that there was a stipulation to restitution. We also have page 80, a simple issue about a health rights cash bond released, which is also page 3 and 4 of the book library. And we also have in there, as is the custom in every case down in Arapahoe County, generic rule 11 that keep stockpiled in a large shelf down the left hand side of this particular courtroom. But what controls is ultimately what we have to deal with, which is the intent of the parties as evidenced by the plea agreement. In this case, it's very clear. This is a factually driven case. It's not really much of a case law issue driven case. Obviously, Rocky is a pretty controlling case, as it's very much on point, specifically page 177, 315 P3rd, 177, subsection 21, that outlines the three-part criteria that are identical to these aspects. But in this case, what happens is, as required, the people have a choice. And the choice they have is either 1, 2, 3, or 4. In particular, they made a very simple selection. They chose number 1. And what's required? Well, specifically, at the time of the sentencing, and this was a final order, nobody's disputing this, even the district court made it very clear this was a final order. At the time of the final order...
Mr. Woodsey, let me interrupt and just ask you about that. So we have a plea agreement here that provides, at least in part, that the prosecution can seek restitution in 90 days, and I recognize on the other page it doesn't say anything about that. Why don't we at least have an ambiguity as to whether this was final?
Well,
what is that you can seek restitution within 90 days mean?
What that means is specifically at the time there has to be an election made. And at this particular time there was no election made. What the court's referencing is the articulated written intent of the parties as evidenced by the plea agreement, page 71, as opposed to, for example, what is the generic rule 11 that is on reference to page 77. And in here, it does specifically say, if the intent of the parties was for 90 days, you have been so advised. If, for example, a simple analogy when we're dealing with double jeopardy, it also advises in the paragraph just above it about domestic violence, the paragraph above it, sex offense, and the paragraph above it, probation, jail. If the insurance company had written a document saying we want him to be a registered sex offender and the court had done so, obviously it would be a very easy double jeopardy issue. Or if they'd said, well, we want to impose up to 90 days because you were given probation, it would be a very easy double jeopardy issue to say you can't just issue that after the sentence has already been over and done because somebody wrote through a document saying, oops, we didn't raise this issue prior to the sentencing. But again, it is being advised in here, which is exactly what this document is. Its sole purpose is to give people, in essence, information about what could happen as part of your sentence if that's how the district attorney elects to go there. But in this particular case, they did not.
So is it your view, I'm sorry to interrupt you, so would it be your view that what the DA should have done here was say the restitution is $4,728 at this point, but we're reserving the right to seek to amend that within 90 days? Is that what they should have done?
Well, respectfully, that's not my opinion. That's actually what the statute requires.
Okay.
Right. The statute specifically says, thou shalt make one of the followings. And before the court can impose a final order, you shall do one of the following. And it's A, B, C, or D. And in this case, they chose A. And nobody's disputing that. In fact, in the court's subsequent order, it even recognizes and states, at no point did anybody choose option A.
Mr. Albany, doesn't the statute actually say that people shall choose one or more of the following?
It does say one or more. And they have the right. And that's exactly why. Because it could say, for example, we go under subsection B. We have no restitution, but we think more is going to be coming because medical bills are going to be envisioned down the road. Or we are electing to go, for example, with B and D, which is what we that are actually in the practice see all the time. Look, we have this amount, we know there's going to be more, and the child, for example, in a sex assault is going to have to go through ongoing mental health therapy and treatment. So we're going to go under subsection C. They're required to notify us of both B and C. That's exactly what the statute says. But in this case, look, without throwing stones, Safeco Insurance, the only document they provided us was the fact that they paid a bill on January 12, 2012, a full year and almost 2 months before the actual sentencing on April 19th. They slept on their rights. The district attorney is bound, as the court points out, the district attorney is bound. It says the prosecution shall make an election and shall obtain this information prior to entering it. Whether the communication is between Safeco not giving them the information, whether the district attorney didn't give them the information or list them as under the Bill of Rights as an adequate victim and provide them notice, that's unclear. Everybody's kind of pointing the finger saying, well, it happened, we're not going to say who's at fault, we're not going to say why. And the answer is the one person that's not is Dr. Bellamy. He took this plea, and the district attorney, as part of the plea, wrote up saying, if you take this plea, you shall only have to pay. If they had only done that election and said, what we know is under subsection A, this is the amount of restitution, but more could be forthcoming, we'd have no issue or no argument. If Safeco Insurance had submitted their documents the year and several months before, year and 3 months before the actual sentencing, we would not be having this argument. And ironically, this whole issue is no longer going to become much of an issue because everything's being done electronically. Good or bad, with ISIS, it makes it much easier for a defense attorney because when we get these notices of restitution, we get them. Everybody knows in advance. The court has them. The district attorney is filing them. So this is actually somewhat of a limited issue because what's happened here is being phased out.
I think you just changed gears, but what did happen when the prosecutor filed their motion to supplement? It took about 5 months, I think, for your client to file an objection.
Right, and as the district court found, there was a no mailing by the Safeco Insurance Company.
What about the prosecution's motion?
That was never received. That's, again, we wish there was electronic filing because now we would have all of this. Nobody had that information, and specifically that is what the district court found.
Neither the prosecution's motion nor Safeco's request for more restitution was served upon the defendant.
Well, Safeco's motion specifically only served it upon the district attorney's office. Mm-hmm. So they didn't even make any they didn't try to give notice to the other sides. Mm-hmm.
And the district court found that the prosecution's motion was not served?
Correct.
What about the court's order amending the restitution amount? Was that received by the defendant?
Yes.
So,
the subsequent order.
The first amended order.
No, the issue that was. What triggered it is actually he learned about it at probation department when they said you still have an outstanding amount of restitution. That's what triggered the whole initiation of what restitution.
So, you're saying the defendant did not receive the first amended restitution order?
And that order was never sent out. And if you look at the court file, there was no mailing to the defendant. The court just made a new order and updated the minimums. That's not something the district courts don't send copies of amended minimuses to defendants or to defense counsel. And again, as evidence of proof that this was a final order, counsel was no longer the attorney of record, Rule 44. Once the final sentence had been done, he's no longer by default the attorney of record. It's now, he's with probation and there was no attorney. So no, none of this had been done and that was what the lower court found. But the issue that, again, disappointingly so, lower counsel, the counsel when they filed the request for a new hearing didn't raise the issue of double jeopardy. Remember, that's what I've got put in there. I'm bound by the record that I have. And not trying to cast stone to find fault with evidence, but it wasn't raised. But candidly, it is a little disappointing that a district court judge who deals with this criminal law every day somehow in his finding didn't even address, kind of omitted the clear double jeopardy issue that is, to someone that's an experienced criminal defense attorney, is the first thing that jumped out at us. It was, well, wait a second, you can't just change the order after the fact because somebody mailed something that they sat on for a year and a half. And if Safeco had mailed those documentation or if the district attorney had had those or reached out to. And again, neither side pointed out whose fault it was. Both of them just said, we've got a problem, can you fix it? And that's the disappointing part of this. It really should have been raised by the district court in its court's order. It wasn't, and so now we have it as a plain error issue.
Mr. Albany, you phrased it as a double jeopardy issue, and you also rely on the Rockin case. The Rockin case seemed to say that it's not a double jeopardy problem to amend a sentence if the statute makes clear that the sentence should, no one should expect the sentence to be final under the statute. So then Rockin went on to discuss the restitution statute and what was required in that case. And in that case, it found that the statute, there under the statute and under the facts of that case, the restitution order was not final at the time. My question is this: if we agree with your interpretation of the statute that it was final under the statute, why do we need to address the double jeopardy issue?
Because it was a final order under the statute, and as Rockin also stands for in subsection 21, it says, if the district court determined a final amount of restitution has been ordered in December 2009, a circumstance withdrew would bar the people from obtaining a supplemental restitution order under 18.13.603 subsection 3. The district court based its determination on the following factors, A, B, and C. A, the sentence entered in December 2000 included an order for restitution in the amount of $8,810. B, the prosecution had not requested to leave the issue of restitution open, and C, the court had not entered in an order reserving a determination of restitution to a future date for restitution hearing. Exactly what we have in this case. Look, if the prosecution had simply said there may be more coming, we wouldn't have this issue. But when they, as required, and again, make no mistake, it's the prosecution under subsection 2 of 18.13.603, the burden falls on the prosecution prior to the sentencing. The court shall base its order for restitution upon information presented to the court by the prosecuting attorney who shall compile such information through victim assistance, victim supplemental, and other means to determine the amount of restitution and the identities of victim.
Okay, I understand your position. If you want to save the rest of your time for rebuttal, you may.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rizzi.
Of course.
Mr. Lee, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee on behalf of People, bar number 38141. The defense argument entirely turns on the existence of a fact not expressed in the record, and one that requires this court to go far beyond what the record provides. The record does not indicate that the original restitution order of $4,728 would be the only restitution the defendant would be responsible for. The best the defendant can do is argue that in context, he had a reasonable expectation that that would be all the restitution he would have to pay. But that argument fails as a matter of fact and as a matter of law. Factually, there's just nothing in the record indicating that the trial court's original order was going to be the final and only restitution amount that the defendant was going to be held accountable for.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Lee. So what else is the court supposed to do? It says the restitution is $4,728, period. Does the court need to say, and by the way, this is final? Why doesn't that period establish that it was final?
I think it does have to say it's final. In this case, if you look at the final order, the court did actually say that was the final order. In the title to the third order, the court expressly says this is the final restitution.
But I know you've been around a long enough time. There's plenty of orders that don't say it's final. It just says order. I mean, in fact, I would venture to say most of the ones I see just say order. Why isn't on the face of it a final order when it says the restitution is as follows, $4,728, period?
Well, and again, in this case, it's not final, again, both factually and legally. So factually, it's not final because when we look at the documents that we had, it's both the sentencing order and the defendant's guilty plea. And as this court already pointed out in paragraph 22, it expressly says that the district court may order restitution, if any, and the prosecution may file another restitution request within 90 days. So those two documents together show that it's a final.
That was entered, the plea agreement or whatever you just referred to predates the court's order, right?
Yes.
Okay. And the statute says if you want to do that, preserve the opportunity to seek more than 90 days, you're supposed to say it in the order. So wouldn't it be reasonable for the defendant to infer, Well, they have the right to seek it after 90 days. The statute says you can put that in the order. The judge didn't say it. I guess they're not going to do that.
Well, when we look at plea agreements, we read them as a common person would with ordinary understanding. So the paragraph 22, the language of the issue is in within 90 days of sentencing. So I guess when we're looking at here, so the restitution amount that was agreed on, the express amount, that was before sentencing.
Yeah.
So that means that paragraph 22 applies from sentencing. So
it's doesn't the statute trump the plea agreement? The statute says if you want to reserve restitution, you know, he's A, B, C, D, put B in there and then everybody will know. You don't put B in there, they're not doing that. Would that not be a reasonable expectation for the defendant? I guess it's the same question I asked about 2 minutes ago.
No, and for two reasons. One, again, the plea agreement is not necessarily bound by the statute. The parties can agree with the court's approval with other things. Most importantly, though, I would say the problem with that argument is under that subsection 1 of 18.1.3, 603, one that the defendant keeps pointing to, as Judge Navarro pointed out, it doesn't say you have to pick one of the following. It says one or more. So under, I think the most reasonable reading in this case is that's what happened. It's one or more. It's that a specific amount that was known to the people was ordered at the time, but pursuant to the express terms of plea agreement that the defendant agreed to, the prosecution could file a request for restitution within 90 days. And there's no way to read those two as being in conflict.
Mr. Lee, the statute asks us to answer the question whether the court has set the final amount of restitution due. So that obviously directs us to look at the court's orders for oral and written pronouncements. That's what Rockney says. What authority do you have that we should be looking at the plea agreements? I mean, I just don't see it in the statute or any of the case law.
The statute says that parties can elect one or two. So I think within the law, that allows us to look at the plea agreement and what the sentence agreement actually was and what the parties thought and what the trial court thought.
But the restitution statute mentions only the court's order. It doesn't mention any other documents that we should be looking at.
Yeah, but I think that when we have the court's order, and again, I think absolutely missing from the defendant's argument here is an express finding by the trial court that the original order was a final order.
And what authority do you have requiring such an express finding?
Well, I think the argument the defendant kind of raised in the reply brief and he's done today here is looking at those first four subsections, the presumption is that any original order would be a final order. The problem with that argument is, I think if you look at 3A of that same statute, the language that the court uses is, because kind of the premise of that is, generally speaking, a court cannot amend a restitution order. But under the same statute, the trial court can both increase and decrease a restitution order after it's been entered. So when we look at
that, if it's not final.
Oh, exactly. So now focusing on language and not final. So in 3A, what the statute says is the trial court can increase a restitution order if the amount was not known by the people or the trial court at the time the order was entered, and it was not, that order was not made due and final by the trial court.
Right, so that tells us to look at what the court has done. How does that allow us to look at the plea documents?
Okay, well let me try to answer your first question, then we'll try and go back to that, because I think it's going to make more sense that way. So the way I read that 3A, and I think the only way I read the statute as a whole, is that before an order can be final, we need to say that it is final. So the question is whether, the presumption is whether a restitution order is presumptively final if the court doesn't say it is, or presumptively not final if the court doesn't say it is. And I think looking at the language of 3A and its purpose, it puts the burden on the trial court to say that it is final. Or the presumption is that it's not final. Because the whole point of 3A is, if the people in the trial court don't know about future restitution amounts, they can later amend it. So if the presumption is that any original restitution order that's not set final is a final order and therefore cannot be increased, 3A essentially has no meaning. Because why would you ever keep the period open if you're unaware of the victims or the future costs?
Even though the order said restitution is X, judgment is this, sentence is this, we should presume that's not a final order? That's what you're suggesting.
I am.
And then the defendant can't appeal because it's not a final order?
It's a final civil judgment, but there's a difference in the law and the statute, and the statute bears this out because it uses two different terms. There's final civil judgment, which would be appealable, so the portion of the order when it enters is appealable under 4A. But as in 3A, it uses a different legal term of art, which is final restitution order, and that means whether or not it can or cannot be amended. So in this case, so going back to answer your factual question, we have an order that I would argue legally is not final. But even assuming, even ignoring that, we have an order that I think, at the very least, is ambiguous. So given that it's ambiguous whether or not it's final, then I think that would require us to look at the plea agreement to determine whether or not...
Within the four corners of the order, what's ambiguous about it?
It doesn't say final order.
So the lack of the word final makes it ambiguous. So every order that doesn't say final is ambiguous as to whether it's final?
Yes.
And do you have any authority for that other than just the reading of the statute you just articulated?
No.
Okay.
But again, I think the statute would be controlling.
Isn't your argument contrary to the analysis in Rockne? Because in Rockne, if they agreed with you that we presume the order is final, or is not final, unless it says it's final, then Rockne could have been a much shorter opinion. It could have just said, well, there's no statement from the court that the order is final, so therefore we presume it's not final, end of the analysis. Instead, they went through this elaborate analysis looking at the entire record to see whether the court's statements were actually final or not. So your analysis seems to be very different from what Rockne did.
Well, not necessarily, because I guess in Rockne the issue is whether or not it was actually kept open as a matter of fact. So I guess, to answer your question...
If they agreed with you, they would have said, it's open. Questions answered by the fact that it doesn't say final, end of story, could have been a two-page opinion.
I don't know if this statutory issue was presented. So yes, it could have gone that way, but I will say, under the logic of Rockne, that also answers your other question of, is there any authority for the basis that we can look at things beyond the document, or beyond the trial court orders? You know, Rockne, the trial court looked at the various orders in the context of the trial court's findings and even the minute order to determine that the people in the trial court had kept the period open and therefore could have been under restitution order. So I would argue that Rockne at least provides some support that we can look outside of the four corners of the original sentencing order.
Thank you.
In addition, I just briefly, independent of the statute, I think the parties put as part of the plea agreement, if the defendant wanted to be final, he should have asked for it to be final. In addition, as we argued in our brief, even ignoring the legal issue, this court can deny the defendant's arguments on the threshold ground that his original objection to the second amended order was untimely. Under 18.1.3604A, it is a final civil judgment, and therefore it is within the confines of Civil Rule Procedure 60, which only allows relief for judgment under certain enumerated grounds. Even the defense below relied on that rule to argue the basis for its request. It argued surprise, but as we pointed out in the brief, that was an incomplete answer to the question. There were two potential sources and two time periods the defendant needed to account for his failure to respond earlier. It was the district attorney's motion and the trial court's order. The only thing the defendant argued in his motions was that he had never received district attorney's motion.
Do you agree that that was never served? Mr. Albany told us none of those things were served on the defense.
I will say the record, based on the trial court did find that they never received the discharge motion. What the trial court did not find, and what the defendant did not argue, and what the record does not establish, is that he never received the trial court's order. So again, we have the people's motion, which is, with people's motion, that we have 5 months, and then we have the trial court granting the motion in September. So that gets the defendant to September. But he doesn't file the motion until February 20th. So he needs to account for the period from September 4th to February 20th. He never did.
And you don't agree that the court's order, you don't agree the record shows the court's order was not served on it?
The record does not show.
Okay.
I will say that the defense counsel is correct that there is no certificate of service. Okay. But at the very least, as the defendant was a moving party, he should have been the one to establish that it was not served, at least as an allegation. He did not make that allegation, so therefore, his request was untimely.
Was double jeopardy raised before the trial court in seeking to set aside restitution?
It was not.
So that's not, although he argues that was never raised by the trial court.
Nope, so that would be subject to plain error.
And do you have any question, Mr. Lee, that if, just make the assumption with me, that the judgment was final, that there is a double jeopardy problem? Do you have any question that, assuming it's a final order, do you agree that it would violate double jeopardy to change the restitution?
Under this court's cases, yes. But again, I would say what it requires, as those cases make clear, is it needs, in fact, to have been a final order. And in this case, I think both factually and legally, either one of which would be enough, it just wasn't a final order.
Mr. Lee, I understand your point that the restitution order creates a civil judgment under the statute. Assuming, accepting that is true, do you have any authority for that, for the notion that Rule 60B, obviously a rule of civil procedure, should apply to appeal or review or challenge to a criminal institution order?
Only it's not sure language. It's referred to civil judgment. We have case law saying that restitution, although it's part of the sentence, is more in line with the civil proceeding.
Is that all it is? Is it simply a civil judgment, nothing more, the restitution order?
Unless it's a final restitution order, I guess, within the main statute. So I guess there's two possible orders. But it, once it's entered, then it is under the statute of final civil judgment. So therefore, I argue that it would be subject to Rule 60 for the civil rules.
Thank you.
Yep.
A quick question, Mr. Lee. Assuming, you know, for argument's sake, we agree with your position, I want to just ask about this request for a hearing issue. You argue that Dr. Bentley never asked for a hearing. The plea agreement here says if he objects, he shall have a hearing. Why does he have to ask for a hearing? Doesn't he just have to object and he gets a hearing?
I'd say there's no need for remand based on two reasons. One, as we pointed out, invited error. The trial court, in its order before the parties filed the motions, made very clear how it intended to proceed. It said, you're going to file, the people file one motion, you can file a response, then the people can file another motion, and then I'm going to issue my order based on the evidence presented in the motions. Based on that, the defendant, by just filing motions, never requesting a hearing, acquiesced to the trial court's affirmative order. So I would say by making that order that took precedence over the plea agreement and the defendant wanted the hearing, should ask for it. Second, as this court explained in Rosales, a restitution hearing is not required if there is no point to it. In this case, it all turns on whether or not it's final or not. The defendant has not disputed on appeal that the amounts were not proven, only that it should have been brought through a civil trial, but again, definitely rejected by this court in sight. So there is just no purpose in remanding it for another hearing, even though the plea agreement said that he shall have the hearing. The court has no further questions?
One more question, I'm sorry, about returning back to the timeliness of the defendant's objection under whether Rule 60B applies. Is it your position that the court had no authority to consider the late motion? It was an abuse of discretion or outside of its jurisdiction? What exactly is your point?
It would be within the confines of Rule 60. I mean, there might be other grounds for it, but as far as I can tell, the court's order, it didn't have any support for its request. So then I think we look at whether the defendant requested the grounds for the trial court to review the order, and that was under 60, and there's no basis under 60 for the trial court to review the order.
So therefore, what, the trial court abused its discretion?
It did, because it improperly understood its discretion.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Roy.
Thank you. We'd ask that you affirm the defense versus charter. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Roy. Mr. Brzee? And just for the purpose of the record, I believe you are Mr. Brzee, correct?
I am Mr. Brzee. I'm happily married. I think all works.
Well, Mr. Albani may be offended. I don't know.
That's a good point.
I apologize for calling you the wrong name earlier.
To my colleagues, in their defense, I get a list of who's arguing, they don't. And so our apologies to you, sir.
That's quite all right. The issue that, again, briefly, that the court focused upon, and obviously, Judge Richman pointed out, his final order, and as Judge Navarro pointed out, well, if it doesn't have the magic word final, does that mean no order is ever final? And candidly, for those in the trenches, those district courts don't actually put the word final on the top of their orders. It's just an order. That's just how the software generates documents. But the issue is, let's look at specifically the language of the court. At the very end, as we point out on page 4 in our reply brief, the court specifically says count 1, count 3 through 7 are dismissed. All felony convictions, as with all felony convictions, would be required to submit to a DNA sample or genetic marker. That will be taken care of through the probation. And as with all sentences, you have 126 days within which to request this court to reconsider any portion of your sentence, 49 days for a higher or appellate court, unless an extension is requested. And then the bond is released. Those are truly, for those of us that deal with criminal law, the last thing that happens as you walk out of the court. When the court is saying to you, and by the way, this is your appellate right, you have a final order. There's no issue. And in the specific case, look, under subsection 18.13603, subsection 1, it says that the order shall include one or more, meaning it gives the court the election. Because what we see all the time, again, for those that are in the courtrooms, is they put an amount and then they put in bracket reserved. Why?
because they're saying, that's what we know now, but more is coming. Or we know the amount under subsection B, but bracket future therapy for child, or continuing ongoing medical physical therapy. And that's what we see on a daily basis. Under the people's rationale, since they never use the word magic final, and in essence, by electing as they specifically chose to do, and nobody other than the Attorney General is disputing, said that it was a specific amount that was selected, specifically on page 125, the court even makes it very clear of the record. The court makes it very clear under its final brief, under its final opinion, that under subsection 8, it says that they chose to make this, and they did not reserve the determination of restitution for a period of 91 days following the sentence pursuant to CRS 1813, subsection 603, subsection 2, but instead requested a sum for certain on April 19, 2013. The only people that are saying it's not a sum certain is the Attorney General. Nobody at any point ever raised that, nobody ever disputed it, and even the court repeatedly reiterated that. And I'm sorry that for whatever reason they didn't do that. That the people, when they made their choice, and they specifically chose to make a choice, and they're stuck with it. And it's that simple. And you can't use hindsight now as a test.
Mr. Brzee, now that I know your name, I'm going to ask two more questions. First of all, you agree that you're on plain error review with respect to the double jeopardy?
Yes.
Issue? What case supports the position that this was a violation of double jeopardy? What plain and obvious law supports your position to make it a plain error argument?
Well, as with the Rocky cases that were all cited, there's a whole string we cited that go along with Rocky that say that this is double jeopardy. And candidly, if something as simple as double jeopardy, from a defense perspective, there's few laws that incite as much passion or, I guess, belief as double jeopardy. One is double jeopardy. The second is you can't beat a confession out of somebody. Those are the two paramount things that, as a defense attorney, you look at it. And if they don't rise to what is lauded in the Miller case of, that this is, if this doesn't rise to the level of something that is so substantial, it should be challenged and overturned, and it should have been done by the district court, then I don't know what is. If double jeopardy isn't that sacred to us, I don't know how you can't say this is plain error to not have done it.
And Rockney was decided prior to these decisions. Was Rockney argued to the district court?
Again, as pointed out, nothing was, double jeopardy was not issued. There was never an actual hearing held.
Even the holding in Rockney that the order has to be, if the order's final, it can't be amended. If it's not final, the rest, was that argued to the district court?
No, the only thing that was really listed was they argued the lack of notice, and they argued the issue on the notice, and that they're not a victim, even pursuant to the statute. There never actually was a hearing where this was done. And again, respectfully, we are bound by the lower court record. I wish somebody would have raised Rockney. And I truly wish the court on its own had said, wait a second, there's double jeopardy.
But you see, we have to find this was plain error. If Rockney never had been cited, I'm not sure how we can find this was plain error.
I think the court can find that this was such an egregious act of what was done that is exactly what plain error is here to correct. Look, attorneys, we're not perfect. I'll be the first to admit it. And in the passion, I can't sit here and say, had they gone to a hearing, they would have argued double jeopardy had they been granted the hearing. I'd love to say that. I can't.
Thank you, Mr. Brzee. Your time is up. And in fairness here, since we gave you an extra 2.5 minutes, let me ask you, Mr. Lee, is there anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, briefly. As I say, defense counsel would argue that we were the only ones who are arguing that the original, order was not final. He cited the trial court's First Amendment order vacating as evidence that the trial court found the first order was final. I would say that that's not clear. If you look at the trial court's final order on page 139 of the record, paragraph 5A, it says that the people made a timely request for the amended restitution order and actually cites back to that original paragraph where it found that the people had not reserved. So I think looking at those two orders, it appears that the trial court actually overruled its original finding. So on page 139, paragraph 5A, the trial court finds that the people did in fact have, file a timely motion.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. We thank you, Mr. Brzee, Mr. Alani, for your arguments. They were very helpful to the court. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. Counsel, you're, in this case, you're excused. And let me ask...